I remember the first studio I taught at, basically the interview process was, are you available Tuesdays? And I said yes. So looking back, I'm like, wow. Welcome to The Piano Sensei Way. I'm your host, Clinton Pratt, and I'm here to help you master the art of running a successful piano teaching studio. This is part two of my interview with Jordan Thomas. Jordan interviews me about running a piano studio. In the first part, just to recap, or if you missed it, we talked all about teacher pay, specifically, what's a fair rate? What other benefits does a teacher get at your studio? What's considered a living wage for a piano teacher? Do you set tuition high in order to pay teachers appropriately? And does that deter clients? How and when can teachers get a raise? And how do you negotiate if a teacher expects or needs more? In this part two episode, Jordan asked me about other aspects of running a studio, such as, what do you look for when hiring a teacher? Do you train teachers? And if so, how? How much leeway do you give teachers for how they teach or what materials they want to use? How do you keep continuity if a student switches teachers in your studio? How do you prepare teachers for transfer students from outside your studio? And if you don't have an admin, how do you manage everything, and when is a good time to hire one? I hope you enjoy the episode. There's a lot of information here.
Kind of also in the same vein of like hiring the right candidate, what do you as the studio owner, like what do you look for in candidates when you're hiring them?
That's a great question. They send me their resume and I throw it away. Seriously, like I'm mostly not kidding. Resumes are just like boring to look at, and I don't really care how many master classes they did or how many degrees. Well, I mean, in a sense, yes, the degrees, but we all know you can have degrees in piano and not know a thing about teaching. Mm-hmm. That's how I was. I had bachelor's in piano, master's in piano. Wow. Okay, I had no idea about teaching. I had one pedagogy class. So the main things I look for are openness to learning. Like they want to be a good teacher and they want to keep learning on how to teach. Prompt and responsible. So I need them to be on time, early actually, and responsive to emails or calls or texts. I think those are the two main things, which might seem weird, but having to have like had to fire people and whatever, because I just can't reach them and they're showing up 10 minutes late to lesson, that's just unacceptable. So they've got to be responsible and prompt and on time and want to be a good teacher.
Mm-hmm. So how much control, I suppose, do you have then in terms of, I guess we could say training the people who you hire on, how much training do you give your teachers in terms of just making sure that, they're providing content to your students in a way that you feel like corresponds really well with the piano sensei way?
Mm-hmm. So I have them observe me for a little while. That's flexible depending on several factors. And I like for them to see me with a student or a couple students or whatever over the course of a period of time, so they can kind of see, what happens, not just like a random lesson, so they would like come every week and observe some. And then at some point I have them take over some of the lesson. So for example, they've come to observe Charlotte a couple weeks in a row, and then like maybe the third or fourth week I have them step in and help Charlotte with whatever piece she's working on, just so I can see how they interact and everything. And then there are basic foundational things that I want everybody to do, as far as like we have a unique achievement program in my studio where they do things in different categories in order to go to the next level and all that stuff. So obviously that's
the students do.
Yeah, the students. So that, you know, so the teachers have to know like that system. And so, you know, we have some training on that. And then, you know, some other things that are important are like teaching students how to practice and including improvisation. And if they, for example, like for improv, if they're like, oh gosh, I've never done that, I'm like, that's okay. Let's do it together. And so then I train the teacher in that, and they see how I do with students. And I also have some videos that they can watch so that I don't have to do it with everybody, you know, just saves time. Yeah. So that's probably more than most studios. I remember the first studio I taught at, basically the interview process was, are you available Tuesdays? And I said, yes. So looking back, I'm like, wow, I would never do that now. Like, are you available Tuesday? You know, like I want to meet the person and talk to them. We have many interactions. They're observing me. I'm observing them. We see if it's a good fit. We decide to move forward, sign a contract and go.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll say that that was my experience in the music school, was that I received no training whatsoever. I was just thrown into a classroom. You know, immediately. And there was, I honestly wish I would have had the opportunity to observe someone else teach, just to kind of see sort of what it was that their expectations were, or even to have somebody observe me just to help me improve my own craft. But I, that not once that ever happened. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's why it also kind of felt a little bit weird to me when the studio owner came to me and said, oh, hey, by the way, I gave you $1.50 raise. And part of me wanted to just be like, well, for what? Like, have you seen me like interact with any of your students? Cause I don't feel like you have. Like, did I really earn this? You know what I mean? It just kind of raised a lot of questions in terms of like, what stock is being put into me as a teacher to improve my craft, to make me more valuable to the school? How do I become a better asset mm-hmm. to this place that, you know, I'm invested in and I want to become better with? And again, I think that also goes back to what you were saying about encouraging your own teachers to get some professional development. Even that was never really an option. So I think that's a really cool thing, just in terms of making sure that they're doing things in the way that you want to see done. Now, this actually leads me into a question that you kind of already brought up, just about curriculum as well as sort of like a benchmark system. And I think that these are two separate questions. So I'm going to start first with the easier one, I think, which is about sort of this benchmark system in terms of tracking student progress. Now, in my own experience, there was a benchmark system at this school. I don't know, it was like a 50-step ladder or something. You know, you go from Mozart to Beethoven to protege to, I don't know, right? Really cool, mm-hmm. creative names. And the only like rule of thumb about it was that a student was required to take a benchmark test every 3 months, no matter what. And I remember asking the owner, well, what is a test? Like, what qualifies as a benchmark test? What should I be giving my students? And the owner said, well, it can be whatever you want. It can be a scale. It can be a piece of music that they're working on. You know, it can be a Simon Says game. And I was kind of like any level, like level one test can be the same as the level 42 test, you know? And essentially the answer was yes. And more or less what I was coming to understand from how it was being explained to me was that it was required that the student pass, no matter what the situation was. And they had to pass because it had to give the parents of specifically children, it had to give the parent the idea that their child was making progress because they have advanced to the next step in this benchmark system. So I guess I'm curious just to kind of hear how your benchmark system maybe looks a little bit different, because I didn't really feel like that was a valid system in terms of actually tracking student progress.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's definitely way different. Now, I do see the benefit of checking something every now and then, you know, like, oh, okay, let's see if you can do this. Right. But to me, it seems a little disingenuous just to be like, well, I have to think of something that they can do that they can pass to tell the parents. So like, even if they're not really making progress, it's still going to appear that they are. Right? It's, yeah, I don't like that at all. Yeah, in my studio, it's called the Benchmark Program, and it's similar to karate belts. We have all the same colors, but they're the symbols are benches, so it's kind of cool.
Okay, so okay, okay. Bench.
Yeah, so there's like a white bench and a yellow bench and an orange bench. But it's very specific, and the levels actually mean something. To go from white to yellow, you have to do several things in several categories, but they're all at that level, you know. So for example, like pentascale in each hand separate, and a broken triad, and then five memorized pieces of a certain level, certain ear tests and sight reading, all this stuff. And then, yeah, to get to the next level, it's more, right? It's two octave scales in certain keys, hand separate, and different inversions of chords, and etc. So it's very sequential and all that, so that by the time you get to black bench first degree, it's legit. You can play, you know, advanced music, and you can do four octave scales, 16th notes, 120, and whatever. It's all laid out. And opposite from that other system you were talking about, if they don't pass, they don't pass. So we don't tell the parents, oh well, they kind of made it to this. No, it's like, no, you're still on the white bench because you haven't done this yet. So, yep, that's how that works.
See, I don't know that I really expected a different answer from you at all, just because if I understand correctly, you also are an examiner for RCM, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I feel like you're very, like, you know, you have kind of a structured idea of, like, sort of how to, I guess, test students in terms of, do you have X amount of skills to be considered level 3 or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. So this makes a lot of sense coming from you, I feel. And I like it. I like having that structure. I think a lot of teachers like having some kind of structure. I didn't really enjoy the benchmark system I had. But this leads me, though, into just about curriculum. How much autonomy do you give your teachers in terms of what they teach, how they teach, at what pace they teach? Like, what kind of autonomy do you give just in their own syllabus and how they teach? Because obviously all teachers are going to have a bit of a different teaching style. They're going to have different ideas of what method books they want to use or not use at all. Is there value in having one curriculum that everyone uses?
They're pretty autonomous, so I don't dictate what materials they use. That being said, I have my recommendations and I have my preferences, and we keep them stocked in the studio of the things that I like, so that it's easier. And also because I think ultimately it's the teacher and not the method, you know. So I know I see a lot of posts, so I'm like, is this method good? Can, you know, or I've used this, like, it's really not about the method. Like, you can use any method or book poorly or successfully, you know. Go faster if you think it's slow, or go slower if you think it's fast, or skip a page if you don't like it, or whatever, right? It's not really about the method. It's more about teaching the skills and all that stuff.
Yeah, so I guess this kind of leads me into sort of one of the other thoughts here about this, and it just kind of leads into one of the issues that I had is that from time to time I would receive a transfer student from another teacher who had just quit, and so I was receiving a new student, and I had no idea, like, what that student's skill level was. I had no idea, like, what method book they were using, because a lot of times the other teachers didn't use method books at all, and that's fine. I'm not going to sit here and say that, like, you have to teach out of a method book. But I would ask the student who was coming to me, I'd say, well, how many years have you been playing, and what have you been working on? And that student had no idea how to answer that question, you know, especially if they didn't have a method book. They would kind of just shrug their shoulders and be like, I don't know. And then it was a huge guessing game for a couple of weeks to really lock down what do they know and what don't they know? What gaps in their knowledge do they have from a previous teacher who just skipped key signatures, you know, like tons of things like that. And so I guess I'm just kind of curious, like, if there's sort of a way that you help kind of facilitate situations like that of, you know, students transferring from one teacher to another and kind of making sort of something a little more uniform to make that transition smoother. Do you offer something like that?
You're talking about like a transfer student from another studio to our studio.
Well, I'm thinking more actually really from just one teacher to another within your own studio, but I suppose that is also another realistic option as well.
Oh, okay. Well, within the studio, we use Teacher Zone, which is a studio management program that does like billing and scheduling and all kinds of things, but it also has the assignments. So teachers type the students' assignments in, and those are saved, And so if a student needs to switch to another teacher, that new teacher can see all of the previous assignments.
So there's a lot of record keeping then with your teachers.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. That's great.
Yeah. So that's easy. What's harder is if a student comes and is new to the studio, but has taken lessons somewhere else. And like you said, what book were you using? Oh, I don't know. Or they didn't bring it, you know? So I always have in the trial lesson stuff, like if you were taking lessons, bring all of your stuff. Okay. But that's part of the trial lesson too, is for me to assess them. And then when I assign them a teacher, then I tell the teacher, look, they had no clue about this, you know, but they were good at copying rhythms and they mm-hmm. kind of remember G clef and F clef and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you could probably start them in this book, you know? And so I guide the teacher that way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. So look, I got like probably I think 2-ish questions left, big ones here. Mm-hmm. The first one is just about teacher-student communication. I go off of a lot of the issues that I had at the school I taught at, but the school I taught at, right, they didn't allow any communication whatsoever between the staff and parents at home. And so like I had a couple of situations, actually many situations, where a parent would drop a student off out front outside the store. And then the student would walk in, come down the hallway, find me. I would teach their lesson. And then they would walk back out to the car and drive away. And I never once saw the parent. And so the only way for me to communicate with that parent would be I would have to send an email to the, secretary of the school, who would then proofread my email, make edits as she felt necessary if she didn't like how I worded some things, and then would then send that to the parent. Then the parent would contact back, and it was like this long chain of events where I couldn't really speak openly because I had to essentially be muzzled with how I worded things. And so it just really constrained how I communicated and what I communicated. And I understand the concern, right? The concern from the studio owner was just that he didn't want me to have their personal information because he didn't want me to steal the students and go and open up my own studio and, you know, take away his business. Like, part of me understands it, but also like it was a huge constraint on how to teach. So I guess it's kind of a twofold question. Like, one, do you struggle at all with teachers stealing your students because of giving them any kind of communication? Or how do you let them communicate without allowing that to happen?
Yeah, this is an interesting topic. I just can't. I don't even... Oh my gosh. No. So that is not the Piano Sensei way. I've never understood that. If anybody listening out there does this, please come on the show and convince me. Because why? Yeah. Why do you restrict? Like, oh, you can't have the parents' email. Because, like, I don't get it. Yeah. Like you said, is it because you're going to email them and say, hey, let's meet in a dark alley and have piano lessons? Like, I don't get that. And no, I'm not worried that a teacher is going to steal students. It's just not going to happen. One, my studio is awesome. So like, good luck finding, doing it better. I'm just confident. And if they do, they do. And that's fine. Like if the teacher wants to leave and not teach and the student wants to go to that other teacher, then okay, that's fine. Like I'm just whatever. I'm not going to sue you because you like took a client or whatever. It's just no. And then as far as the communication, no, all of my teachers, they have phone numbers and emails of clients they are encouraged to communicate with. And actually Teacher Zone has a chat feature to it so that you can send messages directly in there. The client can send a message and say, hey, we're going to be 10 minutes late today, you know, so they tell the teacher. I don't want them telling me and then I have to relay the message, you know? Yeah. And that's another thing. Like, since we aren't a huge school, like I don't have a secretary or administrator or whatever, I imagine they could be helpful in certain things, but not to like be a middleman for all communication. That just seems inefficient. So, and especially if it's like related to a lesson, you know, the teacher wants to tell the student something like, oh, hey, I forgot to tell you this, or hey, just checking in, how is this going? Like, that doesn't need to come to me and then I send it to them. So I've never understood that.
I mean, on that subject, like, I will say that, like, you know, and maybe this is just maybe he made the right decision at the time in the context of what it was. But, you know, there was a situation once where I had a student who, you know, wasn't practicing. And it comes back to the question of, you know, how much practice is a reasonable amount to expect your students to make? And I had tried sending a parent who I had never met before just an email about, like, you know, their her son's practice and whether or not he could find more time to practice. And the studio owner who intercepted the email through our natural system, you know, came and spoke to me privately and said, hey, you cannot ask a parent to have their child practice. You cannot ask them to practice because that will discourage them and runs the risk of them quitting because your expectations are too high. Now, I want to clarify here. I wasn't asking them like they need to practice every single day. I was simply just sending an email saying like, hey, like, is there any way that, you know, we could encourage practice at home?
Yeah, yeah.
Even if it's just one day. And I kind of felt a little bit like, well, this is kind of wild to me. Like, I can't even ask for like one day of practice. I can't like talk about practice. Like, it felt very much like, again, I was being muzzled on just like how to help the student grow. And I couldn't have that conversation at all at the risk of them quitting because expectations were too high.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting, to say the least. Do you want to connect with other teachers in person? Do you want to learn new teaching strategies and explore outside the box approaches? Join us at the Creative Teaching Conference, a radical retreat to recharge and reinvigorate your teaching. This unique conference was started by me and my two friends and colleagues, Christopher Oyl and Tony Parlapiano, back in the summer of 2022. All three of us had so many ideas we wanted to share, but instead of trying to get selected for an MTNA or NCKP conference, we created our own event. We each present a few workshops, but we also have guest presenters as well. Topics include improvisation, composition, student-led learning. You'll experience inspiring workshops on creative teaching strategies and creative performance ideas. Learn about different ways to structure lessons, such as online groups, memberships, and subscription models. We eat meals together and plan social time so you can connect with teachers from all over the country, forming new musical friendships that will last a lifetime. Mark your calendars for July 7 to 9, 2024 in Cincinnati, Ohio. Check out creativeteachingconference.com for more info.
Actually, I have sort of a quick unexpected question just because you brought it up, just in terms of like, do you hire on somebody, a secretary of sorts or whatever you may want to call that person? Because I guess I'm just curious, like, if you don't have one hired, then does that mean that you have to always be at the studio every single day that you have teachers there in order to answer phone calls of incoming students or to be present in case somebody walks in? Or does it not allow for you just to have some like time off ever, like as the owner?
Right. That's a good question. So right now I'm physically at the studio 4 days a week. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Mondays, I'm not there. There are three teachers there. We have three studio rooms, so all the rooms are full. It runs without me. Saturday, I've got a teacher there teaching. I'm not there. It runs without me. We don't have a physical phone. Phone calls go to my cell phone.
So even if you're home, if you are at home on a day off, like you'll still take that phone call and open up a computer and put in their information or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And we don't really get walk-ins, but if we do, my teachers who are there know what to do. They just say, sorry, we're an appointment business. Here you go. You can schedule a free trial lesson. So then gotcha. They just book that. Yeah. So that's the situation right now. Cause like I said, we're not that huge. So I'm the administrator and the secretary and the janitor.
Yeah.
But yeah, I imagine if and when we grow, like hiring somebody to do some of the tasks, you know, that I don't need to.
Yeah. Okay, great. So look here, this kind of leads me into sort of my last question, because this has been super informative for me just to like better understand like how a business model could work better. And actually, like, you know, not have maybe a rotating door of teachers going through it. But for somebody like me in my situation, though, where I'm looking to expand and scale up to be something larger than just a private studio. I guess this might be a twofold question, but one, how does any teacher listening right now who may be in a similar situation where they're turning away business because they just can't keep up and they want to expand, how do they know, one, that that's a right fit for them to move into becoming a larger school where they hire on someone else to teach for them? And if they are the right fit for that, what are their first steps into making that a reality? Is it finding a commercial space? Is it looking to hire on teachers? Is it going ahead and giving the green light to some students who are on a wait list that they're going to start before you even have all that set up? Like, what? How does someone make the jump?
Yeah, it's a good question. For me, it was gradual, and I liked that, and I'm grateful for the gradual process. In other words, like, it was just me and my one studio room that I had. And then I hired one teacher to start taking students when I wasn't teaching, you know, and then grew to like another room and another teacher and then moved out into another space, etc. I recommend that because it's just less risk and less stressful, and it's nice and gradual. But
so you had a studio space where you had multiple rooms. You could accommodate a second or a third teacher. You just weren't using them. You were just using it just for yourself initially.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, which that was a nice setup. You know, that's hard to find, where like there are other rooms, but you don't have to pay for them until you need them, type thing. Yeah, because if you're going to rent a space and like looking to grow, then you want it. You want it to be big, but if it's not full, you're not going to afford it yet. So there's a risk. But I know some other teachers who have done that. If you build it, they will come, kind of idea, you know, like, hey, we're just going to take the risk, going to get this commercial space and all of that. If you do that, I would recommend having teachers ready, you know, like start planning. So you're starting to interview teachers and all of that before, right? Like, don't sign the lease on a space and then look for teachers, right? Plan it so that you're like growing your wait list and or having students who are going to be ready to start. You're having teachers or at least one other teacher, and then take the plunge. Did that answer your question?
I mean, yeah, sure. I feel like it's a very big open-ended question, right? Because obviously, you know, moving from a private studio to a music school is very multifaceted and, you know, can venture in 15 different directions, right? There's obviously, it's more complicated than simply just take this step, then that step, and then you're there, you know. But I do feel, though, like a lot of people in my situation, myself included, who want to take that step, there is kind of the like overwhelming sense of, well, how do I make that step? Like, what do I do first? What do I prioritize first? You know, and so that part can just, it can feel overwhelming.
Right. And like, if you have a space, then, you know, you could start with hiring a teacher to use that space when you're not. So then, you know, there's no other expense or anything, you know, even if it's a home studio or something. Or if you're a travel teacher, well, maybe that's even easier because there's no space. It's the students' homes, right? And you're just managing and overseeing. Same with online, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, and actually, I take, you know, lessons today with a teacher through an online school that I didn't even know existed until just, you know, maybe sometime in the last year. Didn't realize that there was an online music school until I just kind of did some Google research and found it. So it shows me that like it can be done. And there is a school, I don't remember their name, but there is a school here in Denver that does just travel teaching. And like that is exclusively what they do. I think is also kind of neat, and it sounds like they're doing pretty well. So certainly can be done. It doesn't have to be a traditional sense of a storefront, I suppose.
Right.
Well, I mean, hey, those are all really all of my big questions. We kind of hit just about everything. I'm sure that I had some other questions. I just forgot to write them down. But I hope anyway that some of my questions were at least many questions that other teachers like me may have been thinking about or wondering, who have kind of been sort of in this headspace a little bit, either having experience being in working at a school like I did, or are currently in a situation where they're looking to scale up.
Yeah. Thanks, Jordan. I think this was really good to do it this way. I liked being interviewed instead of like me doing the interviewing. So that was fun. And yeah, I think a lot of that is helpful. Yeah, maybe we can do it again with like another topic or more of this. So
I got plenty more questions to ask.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's do it again. All right. Awesome. Well, thanks, Jordan. And everyone, take care. Be sure to also, like I said, check out the YouTube channel. It's also The Piano Sensei Way. And go to thepianosenseiway.com. Take care.